Welcome to episode 62. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health as it continues its way through a year of intense bargaining. We've recently issued proposals to members for bargaining with respect to the medical scientists agreement, covering dietitians, pharmacists, audiologists and psychologists, the health and allied agreement, and the allied health professionals agreement. These detailed documents are intended to give information to members to respond to so that we can develop our position as we seek to finalise negotiations with respect to those agreements. In terms of our ongoing bargaining with VAHPA for allied health professionals, we're not attending the Fair Work Commission this week, but we are back to the Commission on the 14th of May. A big thanks to all of those community health members who have made time to attend the Fair Work Commission with us. In terms of our health service members, we're continuing to work towards implementation materials for the two doctors' agreements as we await its approval by the Fair Work Commission. An implementation guide for each agreement has been developed and provided to the AMA for their review and comment. We anticipate that we'll be conducting EBA forums in late June. Those will be at a mix of metro and rural destinations, but we'll be taping one of them so that if you are unable to attend one of the scheduled EBA forums for doctors, there will be the material available to you at a later date. With respect to the maintenance agreement, we are still waiting for approval of that agreement, but a big thanks and a big congratulations to those members who managed to secure a majority vote. For biomedical engineers, we are continuing to negotiate for a new agreement with a meeting on Monday. For dental therapists, drafting continues for an agreement based on the heads of agreement. That draft agreement will then be considered for approval by the government. This week, we also have our HRIR regional and rural managers meeting, and we look forward to engaging with members at that. There is an SDPPWG meeting for health and allied this week, although the SDPPWG meeting that was scheduled for allied health professionals has been postponed to later this month at the request of the union in order to attend the Change the Rules rally. As always, all of our meetings and our industry activities are summarised on the VHAA community app. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is workplace relations consultant, Rem Richards. Welcome, Rem.
Thanks, Stu.
Rem, would you be good enough to reveal a clue for our subject of discussion today?
Yes. Wow.
So for the benefit of those people who are listening to this podcast rather than watching, could you describe the object?
It is, do you put it at the end of a door? Keep the draft out, what do they call those things?
Ram, I think this is a first. This is the first time where a person has not been able to identify the object, much less the subject for discussion. This, Ram, is a dinosaur tail.
A dinosaur tail?
You attach it using these ribbons and then you become a dinosaur.
I was going to say, I suppose you get fatigued from doing that.
Well, on that basis, what would you say that the subject matter for today's discussion is?
Given I've just given it away, fatigue.
And how does this dinosaur tail connect to that subject?
Well, I would think it takes a lot of effort to attach it to a dinosaur. That might be the reason.
With being extinct and all.
Yeah, great point.
Yeah. Well, that's completely incorrect. And the proper connection is that dinosaur tail leads us to dinosaur.
Yep.
Dinosaurs lead us to famous dinosaurs. There are no more famous dinosaurs, I don't think, than say, Dorothy the dinosaur. That leads us to the Wiggles, and that leads us in turn to everybody's favourite purple-hued narcolept, Jeff. Jeff from the Wiggles had that fantastic habit of falling asleep.
Yes.
And that takes us to this week's subject for discussion, fatigue.
Market.
One of the things that we've been doing in the context of the Medical Scientists Agreement is working through our list of implementation issues.
Yep.
And there are a couple of external documents that are referred to in that enterprise agreement.
Yep.
And that's really what brings us to our subject for discussion today. One of the external documents that's referred to is the Safe Work Australia's Guide to Managing Risk for Fatigue at Work. Rem, you've done some work in terms of summarising those documents. So first of all, we should say, If you want a copy of the full document as referred to under the enterprise agreement, you will find that
under my IR.
Under my IR, if you go to the enterprise agreement page for the medical scientists agreement, it's on that page. But just in case people don't feel as though they have sufficient time to get their heads around it, given that it's about 26 pages long.
It's a lengthy document.
There is a short summary that we are preparing, which will be an implementation guide, and we'll be talking about that implementation guide today. So let's start from the very beginning. Where is that summary guide process up to?
So the summary is with the union at the moment, and they're considering... I suppose that the information that we've included in the summary, and we're expecting to get some feedback towards the end of this week.
End of this week, excellent. And once that summary is settled, we will then publish that and make that available. That will complement this podcast. So to start at the very beginning with regards to the Safe Work Australia's view, I know how what I think fatigue is and how I define it, but for the purposes of that organisation and that document, how do they go about defining fatigue?
Yeah, so they define fatigue to be a state of mental or physical exhaustion, or it could be both, which reduces a person's ability to perform their work safely and effectively.
That's interesting. So it's not just about the experience, but the impact that it has.
Yep.
And in terms of how that occurs, how does fatigue occur?
Yeah, so in the guide, they really talk about prolonged mental or physical activity, sleep loss, and or disruption to the body clock. So really, it's a multifaceted problem because it can occur in a work context, but it can also occur from a non-work-related context, which we will get to later in the podcast.
So this may seem like quite an obvious thing to go through, but why is fatigue a problem?
Yeah, so the obvious one is that it can adversely affect safety within the workplace, and that it reduces the alertness of an employee, which may lead to errors and an increase in incidents and injuries. It's particularly the case when you're undertaking critical tasks that require high levels of concentration and things such as even undertaking, shift work when a person would ordinarily be sleeping.
So shift work is an interesting one and quite a challenging thing for our sector, which relies on shift work in order to provide services. So just I'll put that in context that the reference to this document is found not under the Occupational Health and Safety Clause, but under the Rosters Clause at Clause 56.1B. And the Rostering Clause does talk a lot about safety and these sort of issues, and so it's in that context that it's referred to. So in terms of fatigue being a problem, what are the long-term impacts that fatigue can have?
Yeah, so I suppose it can lead to heart disease, diabetes, higher blood pressure, and that constant feeling, I suppose, of feeling physically exhausted, which, you know, go hand in hand with working generally, but there is that particular focus on their long-term issues around high blood pressure.
So we've talked about what fatigue is in terms of the Safe Work Australia guide and the summary. We've talked about why it's what can trigger it and why it's a problem. How do people go about identifying it?
Yeah, good question. So identifying someone that is feeling fatigue is really a matter of observation. So the guide really talks about how your staff member or your employee may be experiencing tiredness, short-term memory loss, impaired decision-making, reduced hand-eye coordination, or slow reflexes.
I think those descriptions are really important so far as that connection to safety, and safety both for the person, but safety for the people who are receiving health services. And what about the less obvious signs of fatigue, the things that you can't necessarily observe?
Yeah, so these are things such as feeling drowsy, feeling tired, headaches, blurred vision, and the need for extended sleep during days off work. So they're the less obvious ones that you're unable to always pick up on, but they certainly have a direct relationship with feeling fatigued.
So Given that we've identified fatigue as a risk because it relates effectively to an impairment, how is the risk of fatigue managed within the workplace?
Yeah, so measuring ways to manage the risks associated with fatigue will certainly vary from one workplace to the next. It might be that members use their existing fatigue management processes to identify that. That would involve identifying factors which may cause fatigue, for example, manual handling tasks, roles that have higher levels of concentration. So that could be, within that sort of surgical space where there are that higher levels of concentration.
Concentration and decision making.
Yeah, exactly. And assessing its risk of injury from fatigue and controlling that risk by implementing effective control measures, which are reasonably practical, would be a way of identifying or measuring fatigue within the workplace.
So tell me, what role does consultation have with respect to a response to and managing fatigue?
Yeah, so it's certainly, from the guide's perspective, it's encouraged, and it's a way of identifying and it's probably the most effective way, to identify questions around fatigue. So it might be that your employee has ideas around managing fatigue for themselves. Certainly from a work health and safety point of view, there are obligations around consulting with your employees around health and safety matters.
That's interesting. It makes complete sense when you identify it in that work health and safety context where consultation is
required,
part of the DNA.
Yeah.
But it's about recognising fatigue as fitting within that framework.
Yep.
So you mentioned earlier that we would talk about the factors that contribute to fatigue. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so one of those things, I suppose, is work schedules. So I sort of alluded that fatigue is often associated with interrelated factors. There's not just one. There's a multifaceted approach. The first one being work schedules. So, for example, working schedules that may limit limit time that workers can physically and mentally recover from work. So their starting and finishing times. Even late finishes on a consistent basis, or working predominantly night shift. Mm-hmm. It could be, even things from an average length of sleep quality, which probably sit in that bucket of the not so obvious signs.
But from that list, yes. Job demands can play a role in fatigue.
Yes, and that really talks about concentrating for extended period of times. And repetitive and monotonous sorts of work or types of work.
But you also mentioned the things that are hard to identify, such as the length and quality of sleep, which I think is interesting in a world full of screens.
Yes, full of screens and full of opportunity not to sleep.
Mm.
I know for me that I probably sit on my phone a bit too much at night, and that can actually contribute to feeling fatigued the next day.
Just making a note.
Yeah. Thanks, Stuart.
You could never tell, Ram. So are there any other work-related factors?
Yeah, so the last one are environmental factors. We don't mean that in the sense of, climate change, but we more mean it in the sense of harsh and uncomfortable working environments.
So just to be clear, climate change is not responsible for fatigue
as
such?
No, there may be people out there that would suggest that otherwise, but that's not what this guide told me.
Okay. So in terms of other, we've talked about work-related factors and the work environment.
Yep.
What about non-work-related factors?
Yeah, so it goes back to that interrelationship, and I think that's really around lifestyle, family responsibilities, health reasons, and outside of work commitments. I mean, those things can be, sporting commitments, uni, those sorts of issues.
So we talked about what the contributing factors can be.
Yes.
I think that leads to the issue of how can they be identified?
Yeah, so I think there are a number of ways to identify issues that may contribute to or increase the risk of fatigue. The first includes consulting with your employees, and that's inclusive of managers and supervisors, on any health and safety representatives about the impact of workloads and work schedules. That would be the first step in consulting with your employees.
So you're really taking that issue of work practices as a, starting with work practices as a way of identifying contributing factors.
Yeah, so examining your work practices in the sense around the degree of control that an employee has over their working hours.
That's a really interesting one in the context of the need to fill a roster.
Yeah.
And also in the context, sometimes we have self-rostering, and sometimes the way in which people self-roster is not always the best way for fatigue.
Yep, that's right. So that that certainly plays into it. And that from that angle, it's important to examine the type of work culture, for example, whether there is an accepted practice to work long hours in that self-rostering space.
So examining worker records might be a way of identifying contributing factors?
Yep. So reviewing things like sign-in and out sheets, billing sheets, shift changeovers is a way of examining and really determining whether there are any fatigue issues associated with those things.
So it's interesting. Those examples will be from the Safe Work Australia Guide, I guess, for us. Well, yep. we have rosters.
Yep.
We have overtime.
Yep.
We have those kind of records to see what work was planned,
yep.
What work has occurred that was in addition to that work that was planned. What about incident reporting? What role does that play?
Yeah, so reviewing incident data or workplace incidents that might have occurred may show whether these incidents are brought upon by fatigue, particularly if there's a repetitive nature of those incidents. And it might also include reviewing how the worker involved in the incident had the time that they had off between the shift that the incident occurred and the following shift.
So fatigue is a contributing factor to incidents?
Yes.
As an OH&S issue, as we talked about before. So that's incident data. What about human resources data?
Yeah, so human resources data could be, for example, reviewing unplanned absenteeism. Mm. You know, I think it's there's certainly a correlation with being fatigued and performing consecutive night shifts and then calling in sick in the third shift. There's certainly that correlation.
I think a lot of members will relate to where additional work is required, in particular, say, double shifts,
yeah.
That the chances of missing another shift within that cycle is substantially higher because of fatigue.
Yep.
So are there particular employees that are at special risk of fatigue?
Yeah, so the guide really talks about shift workers, which is inclusive of permanent night shift workers. So they actually put them at a pretty high level of being affected by fatigue.
That's really interesting in the context that it's not uncommon
no.
to have permanent night shift workers within our sector.
Yep.
But it's quite a challenging thing to start to think about that as potentially not being a healthy or good thing.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's that the other factors are certainly in that on-call recall space. And it goes back to that disruption of sleep or being awake when you ordinarily would be asleep, that would actually lead to that feeling of fatigue. And the next one more broadly is probably emergency service workers and those within medical professions.
So that's effectively three different ways of saying that our entire sector is at risk of fatigue.
Yes,
very okay. much.
Yes.
The Safe Work Australia guide and the summary refers to safety critical incidents.
Yes.
And what do they mean by those? So safety critical tasks.
Yeah, so safety critical tasks are those where the consequences of a mistake or an error in judgment may cause serious injury.
So the stakes are high?
The stakes are really high.
Margin for error is small?
Very small. And we're really talking about, you know, as an example, is participating in medical or surgical procedures.
Mm.
You know, clearly there's a high level of concentration that comes with that, but also the risk of mistake or error in judgment could certainly lead to some pretty dire circumstances.
It's interesting to hear how relevant that is for our sector.
Yes.
So we've talked about identifying contributing factors to fatigue. What about assessing risks?
Yeah, so risk assessment methods are like, are very similar to the methods of identifying risks of fatigue. So things like consulting with your employees, examining worker records, reviewing human resource data and workplace incident data are a good way of assessing the risks associated with fatigue.
And in terms of controlling that risk?
Yeah, so the best way to control a risk of fatigue is to eliminate the cause of the fatigue or the risk that leads to the fatigue. But if that can't be achieved, because it's not reasonably practicable for the health service to do that, then the next port is minimisation. So minimising the risk, particularly, I suppose, in the context of, let's say work schedules, that would really be about developing working hours and rosters to allow for good sleep. Notwithstanding that we acknowledge that that is sometimes or certainly wouldn't be practical for our members.
We have a service imperative, but we also have a duty of care, both to employees and to patients. Yeah. So in terms of work schedules or rosters and coming up with ensuring that rosters support support avoidance of fatigue, what else can be done in the context of shift work in particular and rosters?
Yeah, so developing procedures to manage and limit excessive working hours. So for example, requiring minimum breaks, which is, observing the 10-hour break obligation.
Which our agreements generally have.
Yes, and managing overtime and shift swapping, and that's also on-call duties as well, and implementing processes to manage accrued leave balances.
There was a reference in the Safe Work Australia document to evenly distributing night shifts. Yeah. And I was curious as to whether that was a reference to in the context of an individual or a group, or both.
Yeah, so it was in the context of an individual, and they do also group it in there as well, that it was either or really, but it's about that mindfulness that not evenly distributing shift working shifts can lead to fatigue and certainly heightens that risk because if you're working, as we sort of said at the start of the podcast, in a night shift space, you're doing so when you're ordinarily, going to be asleep, which would mean that the next day you're likely to feel fatigued or you may experience a feeling of fatigue.
When we're talking about rosters and the like, we're talking about things within the control, generally speaking, of the employer.
Yes.
What about those non-work related factors?
Yeah, so that's really about developing a workplace fatigue policy for all workers, but also educating employees about identifying the risk, identifying and managing the risk of fatigue. I think that kind of ties in with that consultation space, but education is a really good way to, I suppose, bring light to fatigue issues, but also it may trigger responses that aren't always work-related, and it could be non-work-related fatigue issues.
So once the control measures are implemented, should they be monitored and reviewed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's wholly, dependent on the level of risk of fatigue. There is no hard and fast rule on how or when they should be monitored and reviewed, but it is really dependent on the hazard of the risk. So the higher the risk, the more times they should be monitored and reviewed, and the lower the risk, not so much the less times, but probably not as much of a focus as the higher risks to be monitored and reviewed.
So, Rem, that's a summary then of the Safe Work Australia guide with regards to fatigue, and that there is also a written summary of that that will be shortly available through the website, through the VHA community app, which will just help members get across that obligation under the medical scientists agreement. What I'm mindful of is, though, the things we've been talking to today are really a summary of that guide.
Yes.
They're not the final word on fatigue. And it's probably worth noting that there's a lot more work going on within the sector.
Yep.
There's work going on at the OH&S industry group level.
Yep.
And I think we're going to be learning a lot more and talking a lot more about fatigue over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I agree, Stuart. I think also from a, from an SDPPWG point of view, that there's a study proposal that the government is currently considering around rostering practices and the impact it has on absenteeism and fatigue. So you're correct to say that there's definitely a lot of work going on in that space.
More to come. Yeah. Rem, thank you so much for taking us through that today.
Thanks, Stuart. We really need you. Wake up, Jeff. You're amazing, all the formula. Wake up, Jeff, before the day's through. Mm-hmm.